For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt survives a six-hour confirmation hearing to head the Environmental Protection Agency. In the longest EPA confirmation hearing since 2001, Pruitt took several questions from Democrats. Neva, your thoughts on yesterday's hearing?
I think Attorney General Pruitt did an excellent job, went through the fire, as all of these nominees to these agencies are going through the process in these committees. Nothing really unexpected. I think the Democrats used the opportunity to ask the tough questions, to play to, frankly, their audience of folks like Senator Cory Booker and others that were, really trying to kind of divide and separate and make some points, score some points, frankly, politically with their own constituents. No big surprises. I think everything that came out was expected. I think what we saw was Scott Pruitt was well prepared and handled it with I think great success. I think bottom line, as we've seen with most of these hearings, they're going to go through the process. It's going to be fully, a fully vetted process. And at the end of it, we're going to find Republicans in the majority on these committees passing the nominee out and ultimately being, I think, passed by the United States Senate.
Ryan, any surprises for you?
Well, I mean, some surprises that are not surprises, right? I mean, given the peril posed to humanity by climate change, it's terrifying that we even have to ask the nominee for the EPA administrator position if he believes in climate change. Brad Plummer in Vox wrote yesterday that it's a testament to how low the public bar has been set that Pruitt's carefully parsed and wildly incomplete statement is deemed acceptable simply because it's not as ludicrous as the statement that Donald Trump says is that that climate change is a hoax. I mean, that's where the bar is. You know, no questions about how are we going to address the impacts of climate change. It's just, do you believe in this? And I think that, that kind of sets the stage because, this is Inauguration Day, and we have to resist this new normal set by this administration, that this cannot become the new normal. The idea that if we're talking about climate change, that the threshold question is, do you think it's a hoax? And so whenever we look at this, the overt appeals to racist, misogynist by a racist and misogynistic president cannot become a new normal. And if it does, it's going to be very difficult for this nation to emerge 4 years from now and have any sort of semblance to the nation that we think ourselves to be.
I think it's very clear, though, when you listen to the Republicans on that committee, I mean, basically what they were saying, and I think it is being affirmed by not only Scott Pruitt, but certainly things that President-elect Trump has said, is that the EPA needs a serious course correction. I mean, now he went on to say during the campaign that he had thought it ought to be abolished, and that was a question that came up. Clearly, we're going to have the Environmental Protection Agency, but it is an agency that has been very top-down driven in its regulatory approach, and I think that we're going to see some real philosophical as well as some real changes in direction, and much of that is long overdue, I think, in the minds of many in the public.
Yesterday, Joe Wirtz brought this up in his story that he did on Pruitt, that if he gets confirmed by the Senate, he will be in a lawsuit against the company he's actually in charge of now. What kind of legal battle does that have to deal with, Ryan?
Well, and he failed to say that he would recuse himself in these litigation. He said that, he would wait until the time came that he would decide then whether or not to recuse himself.
And he would also take into account what legal counsel said at that time. So he didn't really leave, I think, any vagueness there. I think it's very clear he's going to do what's appropriate if he is head of that agency at that time.
But let's remember who he's in these lawsuits with. He brought these suits alongside the oil and gas industry, and I think that was something that was also very clear in yesterday's hearing, or in Wednesday's hearing, that Scott Pruitt has, throughout his tenure as Attorney General in Oklahoma, been a champion for the oil and gas industry at the expense of the people of Oklahoma. And he uses this idea that he's confined by the law. He kept being, Senator Sanders asked him, what did you do on the front with earthquakes? Well, he said, that's not really I don't have any authority in Oklahoma. Well, that's not really the case. He does have some authority there, but he didn't use his bully pulpit either. And he would say at the EPA, I don't really have the ability to act on these issues because it's not what Congress has intended. But he's done just that in the state of Oklahoma. He's been an activist attorney general whenever it comes to prosecuting our neighboring states regarding marijuana or protecting the oil and gas industry, but he's been silent on things like earthquakes, where he does have a mandate as well.
Another accuser comes out against State Representative Dan Kirby in sexual harassment allegations being investigated by a House committee. Former aide Carolyn Johnson testified he asked for nude photos and accompanied him to a strip club. Meanwhile, Stilwell Democrat Will Forkiller, who is also getting investigated, refuses to speak before the committee unless it gets open to the public. Ryan, let's start with Forkiller and your thoughts on his refusal to participate in the investigation.
You know, I can see his point that, you know, that he wants, if he wants to have a hearing here, that it ought to be public. And there are, I think, ways to do that in a way that protect the other witnesses, that protect the person that's made the allegation against Forkiller. But if he's going to do this, you know, to have it in secret, I think makes it very difficult for them, for him then to defend himself publicly. And again, all of this is really lost on the bigger issue here. You know, the excuse of the chairman of this committee is that if they do this, that it will somehow discourage future complainants from coming forward. That misses the point entirely. What discourages people from coming forward to report sexual harassment or potentially sexual assault is when you fire them, when you terminate them after they come forward. And that's exactly what happened here. If you don't want to discourage employees from coming forward, you don't fire them. And there's all this outrage over a settlement being paid or whether the House was authorized to do that. But where is the outrage over the fact that a woman was fired because she came forward? That's what started all of this to begin with. If the House had done its legal job and duty at the forefront, we wouldn't be here today.
Neva.
Well, I think we've got two kind of different circumstances. Forkiller, from what has been said so far, this was an instance where you had an upset high school page back in 2015 at the Capitol, that issue was addressed. We have to assume at the time that probably parents of that minor child were probably involved. And so that's one set of circumstances that is being has been identified and is being addressed. The other are these sexual harassment allegations and all that's gone on with respect to Representative Kirby, a much different circumstance. Mm-hmm. And one, frankly, there had been a lot of speculation, a lot of surmising that there was going to be more than one allegation come forward. So not a surprise to a lot of folks kind of inside the building, I guess you would say. But it is something that does need to be clearly resolved. I think it's fascinating that that we now are seeing steps being taken where the handbook that these employees now are being asked to, you know, read and sign clearly says that they cannot be involved with their boss or with an elected official. And some of that. So clearly steps are being taken to try to alleviate some of this in the future, but they do need to address it. They need to get it fully vetted, and they need to get it behind them and resolved before the session gets started.
Well, and it sounds like with Republican Dan Kirby, there was some serious allegations, and more serious allegations are coming forward. He was about to resign. He decided not to, and so they opened up these investigations. And it just seems like they threw the Democrat in there just kind of because they wanted a Democrat.
It does seem apples and oranges. I mean, it really does in terms of the scope of what we're talking about in both instances.
Yeah, totally two separate inquiries. I mean, the debates over transparency, over the House's authority to pay these settlements, All these things, I think, again, are really a sideshow to the bigger issue of a person was terminated because they came forward and there was a settlement paid. I mean, that is just, you know, cut and dry how a sexual harassment case proceeds. And it should have proceeded if an employer fires somebody because they come forward.
I think the overarching point is that they are looking at this. I think they do understand and recognize they have to address it, that it is a serious problem, and that they need to put it, they need to sufficiently take care of business so that the public does believe that it has been properly handled. And I think that's the threshold that many of the members and across the board, including some of these new freshmen coming in, who kind of got slammed with that right on their front door after the election, not knowing anything, and really, I think, perplexed by some of the information that has continued to unfold, much of it in the media long before it has been actually inside their caucus or inside the building.
And a lot of these things happened in 2013, 2014, 2015, and the people who were in charge are no longer in charge. Is there something to be said about the fact that the leaders can just kind of leave and leave behind kind of a mess?
It's the nature of the process. I don't know how we alleviate that.
I mean, they do it with statutes all the time. They pass bills and, you know, they wreak havoc on the state's economy or civil rights or whatever it may be.
Now stop
and then
talking
gone.
About yourself.
Well, but the leaders were.
Hey, I was in the minority. I didn't pass very many bills.
Voted out. The leaders were taken out because of term limits. Right, I mean, that's does that give kind of a freedom to a leader to go, well, I'm going to be term limited by that time anyway, so...
Well, and that's where I think that you have to have this institutional continuity. I mean, the legislators themselves may come and go, whether it's because they decide not to run for re-election or they're not re-elected or they're termed out. You have to have institutional continuity, and that institution is the one that is obligated to both its employees and the people of Oklahoma. And so regardless of who made those decisions, the institution remains liable
for those
decisions.
And out of these type of instances, what we do find is some correction. We find that they take measures to hopefully thwart that from happening at some point in the future.
Last week, a task force working on criminal justice reforms released recommendations saying it could save the state $2 billion over the next 10 years through sentencing as well as changes to the pardon and parole process. Neva, what do you think about this report from the governor's justice reform task force?
Well, I think that Jennifer Chance, the governor's general counsel, maybe had the best phrase for it when she said it was jaw-dropping. When you really look at these statistics, I mean, it is amazing. When you have the state's incarceration rate at 78% higher than any in the nation, and that we've had an increase, I think it was every year for the last 38 straight years, I mean, that points to not only a problem, it points to an absolute a situation that is long overdue and being addressed. So I think we're going to see some real focus on this, and I think that, you know, the $2 billion savings over a decade is certainly one of those price tag figures that makes everyone pause and step back. I think much of what's been said, much of what they have done in terms of the task force findings and all of these statistics and figures do point that clearly to the fact that the time has come for these things to be properly addressed. I think we saw it, as we talked about many times last fall, mm-hmm. with even the public, you know, really coming into focus with the state questions and determining that we've got to do something, quit talking about it, we've got to have some real results.
Ryan.
You know, Jennifer Chance's comment that Neva just mentioned, she said that it's been interesting to be exposed to some of the data. It's been shocking. I mean, jaw-dropping shocking. I totally agree with that. Yeah. My question is where have you been? I mean, these are not, you know, we've gone through this entire task force, and a lot of these numbers that we're getting are numbers that those of us that have been working on the criminal justice reform front for the last many years in Oklahoma, we've been trading in these numbers. I mean, these are numbers that we're very familiar with. This is nothing new. You know, that what Neva describes, it's an epidemic. It's an epidemic that is draining the state of valuable resources at a time when we have a structural budget deficit, but it's also creating a public safety crisis in the name of trying to say that it's about public safety.
But the public safety crisis has been precipitated by the fact that you have many district attorneys, many sheriffs, many in law enforcement who are still of the mindset that even if this is a first-time offense, even if it is a nonviolent crime, even all of these statistics that we see that have piled up and piled up and piled up, there's still a great mindset out there that we're still going to throw them in, you know, we're going
Absolutely.
To throw them in jail and let them sit regardless of the fact that we've proven that when you put them in jail, all you're doing is compounding the problem over and over and over with all of the other unintended or, you know, results that they may not think are significant, but have proved to be totally detrimental to the entire, you know, entire societal process. And
right.
And I think, you know, it's compounded by other factors that they now are having to address, such as the mental health component, which were some of the statistics that I think were very shocking to
people. And yesterday was the bill deadline. And there are still bills that have been dropped that increase penalties, that put more people behind bars, even for
right.
nonviolent offenses. So even though, yes, you have the district attorneys and you still have lawmakers who are trying to do the tough on crime.
And when
bills.
People, I think when the public recognizes and starts to hear these statistics over and over and over again, that 75% of the admissions into the prison system were for nonviolent offenses, and more than half of those for first time
right.
offenders. I mean, it points to the problem that we have a broken system, and you know, and hopefully we can get folks to the table and somehow begin to at least get some of these folks that are so strident on the other side to begin to moderate their viewpoint, or at least give us an opportunity to do something other than just continue to try to pour money in where there's no money to be had.
And it also seems to throw away the key mindset with our women, who are number one in the nation for women behind bars. It's that mindset, I guess, of judges that, you know, if you've done one thing wrong,
Well, and among the women, they said 70% of the women had either managed or had identified mental health issues. Yeah. I mean,
sexual trauma, sexual abuse.
Think about the complications that come just with that one statistic.
And if you look at who makes up our prosecutors, you know, I looked at a study recently that showed that, you know, our prosecutors are almost exclusively men. Even among assistant district attorneys, you have more men, but among DAs, it's almost exclusively men. And even there, almost all are white. There are very few non-white prosecutors out there. So taking into context the perspective of the people that are being sentenced and the disproportionate numbers of both people of color and of women, I mean, it begins to make some sense. I think, you know, the biggest impediment to criminal justice reform in the state of Oklahoma right now, not the people of Oklahoma, it's prosecutors who are tied to this draconian notion that they have to lock up as many people, that they have to have a conviction rate that's, you know, 90-95%, and get as many sentences as they can to get reelected, which is itself a false narrative, but one that they have just believed with utmost confidence, and it has to be broken.
And when you think about that, these very folks that we're talking about, district attorneys will be up for election or reelection in 2018. So this is a perfect backdrop to begin to make that a focus, not only of debate in the legislative chambers, but also out there in the counties and the districts where these folks are either running for reelection or people that are challenging and wanting to elevate this debate and dialogue. I think this is a perfect opportunity, and hopefully we'll see some of that.
That's right. Biggest place that you can affect as a voter the criminal justice reform system or the criminal justice system in Oklahoma at the ballot box is with your DA. If you don't like the criminal justice system in the state of Oklahoma, change your district attorney.
And to be fair, not 100% of the DAs have been the opposite side of this, but clearly a significant majority have.
Well, and voters need to be grilling their DAs and the candidates about these issues. Ask about these questions, and if you don't like those answers, throw them out.
A crowded field of candidates signs up for a special election to fill the seat vacated by State Representative Tom Newell, who resigned his seat just days after winning re-election. The candidates include 5 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and a Libertarian. Ryan, I understand you have some experience with this Seminole district.
Just a little bit. Now, that's my home turf.
And Tom Newell took over from you after
Tom. He did. And, you know, the voters there, I've said, are still suffering from the whiplash of going from one of the more liberal members in the state's history to one of the more conservative members in the state's history. And, yeah, I think that what this tells us with this crowded field is that we're most likely going to have a runoff election. It's very difficult to imagine that even on the Democratic side that somebody emerges with a 50% margin and goes straight into the general election. So the expense of Tom Newell's decision to abandon his post immediately after the election and take what we can imagine is a very lucrative position with a conservative-based think tank based out of Florida is going to cost the people of Oklahoma all that much more money. This campaign is, you know, really, if there is any benefit to it, it's that the people of that district now have a chance to perhaps elect someone who will be an actual voice for the people of that district. I look back and it's my hometown, and you're struggling with the schools are struggling there in particular in Seminole right now. There's a big issue with education. Rural poverty. I mean, these are things that are all very real, and I would just hope that the people in that district take this opportunity not to listen to somebody who's going to, you know, blame some other marginalized group for their problem, but it's really going to say, listen, if we're going to raise the standard here with education, health care, and rural poverty, we got to raise revenues on the upper income earners in the state of Oklahoma. We have to have a candidate that does that. We'll see who emerges.
Neva.
Well, out of the 10 candidates, a number of them have run for office before, either this seat or some other seat. So you have some folks at least have some experience being a candidate out there. I think it is fascinating when you look at it that this really sets up for on both sides, you know, Republican and Democrat in the primary. They've got to take it in the primary. It's not like a regular election. It's a special election. Someone's going to be the nominee, and then they're going to have the general election in early May. So this seat basically is going to be without a representative this entire legislative session.
Thanks, Tom Newell.
And so we have a situation where will the public pay any attention to it, and will these issues, just like you mentioned, Ryan, will they be significant enough that people will say we need to figure out who the best person is among this mix and get them up to the Capitol starting to take care of business those for our district. You know, as we know, classically, these types of elections are very low voter turnout, very low interest, coming off of a very bitter partisan elections in November. And I question whether or not, any of these folks can do a really good job of galvanizing their base and getting them out to the polls on the first vote on March the 7th. So I think that's going to be the real challenge in this race. And it'll be fascinating to see who emerges on the Republican and the Democrat side for their nominees.
Primary March 7th and general election May 9th. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a quick turnaround.
And, you know, I hate to say it, but perhaps having no representative for this district is better for this district than having a representative like Tom Newell, who has actively worked against the interest of that district for the last several years.
Tom Newell was overwhelmingly reelected in November, even though he did not continue on to serve in that capacity for another term. So to suggest that the voters weren't unhappy with him, I mean, there's no validation of that point. I think what is clear is that this is one of those unique opportunities where they have a special election. They have folks that can come out. Everyone had an opportunity to look at this seat to run. And frankly, it is one of those rare times where in a compressed time frame, it's less about money, more about organization, and more about getting your name out there and figuring out whether you can connect with the voters.
The 2017 annual count of Oklahoma registered voters shows Democrats are continuing to hemorrhage members to Republicans and independents. The GOP makes up nearly 46% of the 2.2 million registered voters, with independents at nearly 15%, while Democrats have fallen to a little more than 39%. Less than 40%. Who would have ever thought that for the Democrats? Neva, your thoughts on these
Well,
numbers?
I thought it was two figures that jumped out. One, that the Republicans last year gained 100,000 new voters, but that the Democrats in their registration for the first time since 2013 actually had about 20,000, new voters. So even though they're still in a slide, there was, I think, as the result probably of the primaries and probably as a result of much of the activity at the national level, there was an infusion of some new folks in that, whether they were switching parties, first-time voters, or switching from independent to Democrat, whatever those statistics are. But I think it does also point to the fact that clearly the strong majority status for Republicans is continuing to only grow and solidify, and these numbers for 2017 validate that.
What do the Democrats need to do, Riven, to try and get the percentage? Yes, the numbers have gone up slightly, percentage-wise, they're failing to the independent. Although they have opened up their primaries.
They have opened up their primary to the independents, and I think that was a smart move. I think that, Democrats have got to figure out what it means to be a true opposition party. I mean, they have, they've probably been an opposition party even though they held majorities since 1992, 94, at the very least. But even whenever they lost their majority first in the House in 2004 and then later in the Senate, now with all the statewide offices, they've really got to figure out what it means to be an opposition party. I think that there is some sort of a roadmap that we began to see during the primaries with Senator Sanders and the activity and the energy that he brought to the Democratic Party and the base in Oklahoma during the presidential primaries. And they've really got to figure out how to seize that and to take hold of that. You know, what we're seeing in these numbers is not all that surprising. I mean, I think that we can say, oh, well, the Democrats are in a slide or a decline. But really what we're seeing is this realignment that's been taking place for a very long time. Right. And Oklahoma is just finally catching up to it. It makes sense that more liberal and progressive candidates and ideas are not going to do as well in a state. And this is just kind of general, where you have low investment in public education and you have low workers' rights, low organized labor. You don't have the types of typical constituencies that are going to be, necessary to build a more liberal progressive agenda. Now, you can overcome that, but it makes it more difficult.
And even the Republicans for nearly 100 years in this state were the opposition party. Is there a lesson that maybe Democrats can take from what the Republicans dealt with for almost 100 years?
Maybe a little bit, but I think it is just the changing political climate. It's the changing climate nationally. It's a changing climate in Oklahoma. I think when you look at independents, I mean, you might suspect that when people are becoming much less identified with either major party, and yet we saw the increase of about 50,000 in the past year to independents. So I think we're not, the shift is still what we're seeing is Democrats moving to Republican, not Democrats moving to independent or libertarian. Libertarians are kind of just on a flat line there, still at less than 1%. So the 15% independents become a factor at some point down the road if they choose to really become more involved in the process, but being only able to be involved in the Democrat primaries and the way that it's now set up, it'll be interesting to see whether they really kind of flow that way or whether they become just kind of this group that is not a major factor in any significant way, particularly in legislative races. And I think that's what we continue to see. You know, in 2 years, we have statewide races. We'll see whether, you know, number one, whether Democrats in this position, can they field strong candidates that can have a populist appeal to Republican conservative voters and get that crossover? And that's going to be the threshold. You know, Ryan talks about this progressive, agenda and trying to get more of the face of what the Democrat looks like nationally. What I think we've seen is a continued rejection of that here at the local level and across Oklahoma in general.
I think, you know, when we look at the growth of independents, one of the things that tells us is that it's difficult to put, I mean, we should avoid the assumption that we can just put Oklahomans into these one of two boxes, right? Democratic or Republican Party registrants. And, you know, the growth of independents suggests that. But I think even among people that still identify with one party or the other, you know, the two-party system does a real disservice to our democracy. It does not do a very good job of reflecting where people's actual attitudes are at. And there are a lot of Oklahomans that are just wildly underrepresented. I mean, if you live in a legislative district, and your legislator is, totally the opposite of you, and you live, and just because of the way that the district is run, you don't ever have representation. That's why, you know, the single member majority district and the two party system are antiquated. We should do away with them.
You know,
we need
the Democrats,
representation, multi member districts, and let's have more voices out there.
The Democrats for 70 years when they were in the majority in Oklahoma, you never heard this argument. No. So I think it is a major statement to say that those who are in power, like that position, and when they're no longer in power, I mean, it's a very difficult position to go from the majority to the minority, and I think that's the struggle. Just like I have said before, for the minority to become the majority and learn to govern and learn to lead, it is a learning curve on that side as well, and I think that's what we continue to see with Republicans as they become more and more entrenched and more familiar with being in positions of leadership and authority, as we see in the legislature right now.
Well, I wasn't around 70 years ago. If I was, I'd probably still be making these critiques. But, you know, I will say, you know, as somebody who's, remains a registered Democrat, you know, I have a lot of reservations about where the Oklahoma Democratic Party is currently going. And I have a lot of frustration at times with Democratic leadership in the House and in the Senate. And I think that what that represents is a lack of ideological diversity within the Democratic Party. And I think that that exists within the Republican Party as well. Our elected representatives don't do a very good job, and not just because of who they are, but just because of the way the system is set up, of actually reflecting the ideological diversity of Oklahomans. And that's where I see it's not really a partisan issue so much as it is an institutional and an issue of systems as to how we can better elect people that reflect the diversity of viewpoints in Oklahoma.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.